This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
My name is Geordie Silverstein and I'm your host for this evening. I'm a historian based at Melbourne University. And I just want to start by acknowledging that we're gathered here today on the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation to pay our respects to elders past and present and to any other elders who might be present here today, and to acknowledge that sovereignty has never been ceded and that colonisation continues in all sorts of ways. And I think, you know, there's really important links here between that we're going to be talking about and that will come to mind as we talk about what's happening in Palestine and in Gaza and experiences of dispossession and control over where people live. So we acknowledge the Aboriginal people whose land we walk on. So we're here tonight to have a conversation with Laila El-Haddad. Laila is a Palestinian writer and chef. Her work has appeared in the Washington Post, in New Statesman, and The Guardian, on BBC, CNN and Al Jazeera. And some of her most compelling work has been published on her blog, Gaza Mum, which she started back in 2004. And the blog interweaves personal stories with grassroots reporting, political opinion and amazing local recipes. She's the author of two books. First one, Gaza Mum, Palestine, Politics, Parenting and Everything in Between, which is a compilation of blog posts and of her journalism, and Gaza Kitchen, the beautiful Gaza Kitchen, A Palestinian Culinary Journey, which was co-written with Maggie Schmidt, and the second edition was newly released and is for sale up the back for those who want afterwards, cash only. But yes, we would love you to purchase a copy and Laila will be happy to sign copies. It's been called a real classic and essential, and Claudia Roden, who's a famed cookbook writer who many of you might be familiar with, has written that we get from this very special book a rare insight into the intimate everyday lives of engaging people who grow vegetables and herbs and raise pigeons and rabbits on their rooftops even as they lament their predicament. So welcome, Laila.
Thank you.
So I guess it's this kind of blend that Roden writes about, this kind of move between the predicament, lamenting this predicament and living vibrant lives, that a lot of your writing, I think, touches on. And so I wanted to think about that and sort of start there. And you write a lot, you talk about, you know, the connections between the personal and the political.
Yeah.
I wonder why, you know, you say that's kind of what you're trying to do with your work, is frame it around this interrelationship between personal and political. And I wonder if you could tell us a bit about how that motivates you.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's. I would like to say, you know, this notion sort of came to me naturally. But I think oftentimes as Palestinians, you know, raised with a kind of jumble of like dates and symbols and really important things and a desperate sense of urgency to kind of preserve these things, be it your culture or you know, the history and so on and so forth. But at the same time, it took a while for those of you who are familiar with Edward Said and his seminal essay, Permission to Narrate, you know, for either, you know, Palestinians to sort of be allowed to narrate their own stories, or even for Palestinians ourselves to accept that our stories could be considered sort of, or our voices rather, could be considered sort of legitimate, and that we don't necessarily need sort of a, you know, validating other to be able to present our stories for us. And so that's kind of the framework I come at it from, but it sort of took a while to come to that conclusion, right? So when I was first starting off and I had moved back to to Gaza and so on, you know, and working as a journalist in hard news, you feel like, well, that's what, you know, you need to write to be taken seriously, right? You need to sort of write like the hard news, and if it's harrowing enough and whatever, the, you know, graphic enough or whatever, people will somehow listen, right? But the result is it just becomes more caricatures or caricature portrayals of Gaza and by extension the Palestinians and so on and their story that doesn't really stick in people's minds. Mm-hmm. And then just, you know, gradually having sort of personal experiences, you know, be it on border crossings or just in sort of routine and mundane moments like raising my son when he was very young at the time, and beginning to kind of document those and receiving some feedback, I found that somehow that seemed to stick with people more, or it was more relatable. And it's sort of absurd to have to say that you need to sort of humanize. But for some reason, because of sort of this dominant media portrayals of Gaza for so long, it's just hard to break that barrier, and people can't possibly conceive of Palestinians as human beings with sort of ordinary feelings and emotions and things and actions and so on. And it becomes easier to ignore them then. And so that's kind of what led me. And also our lives as Palestinians are sort of inescapably political. And so, that was part of it. But it was always this attempt to kind of like separate the personal from the political. Like, well, who? That's going to be considered frivolous. Who really wants to hear about, like, you know, raising your child or the dilemmas of, you know, mothering or so on and so forth in the context of, like, you know, all these big geopolitical issues. But, like, as it turned out, it was kind, and again, it was related to this whole concept of, you know, of permission to narrate and finding one's voice and kind of owning that narrative and that voice. And so it took me a while to kind of own that and accept that, but I found it to be the most effective way to convey, you know, my small sort of boring story, but then by extension, like, you know, part and parcel of the larger Palestinian story.
So you mentioned Saeed, and I wonder, are there other Palestinian writers who are also doing this kind of work that you're talking about, that you sort of see yourself as?
Well, these are, you know, he's sort of more a classic, obviously late Palestinian, author and critic and so on. But I think you only sort of in the last 10 years began to see the emergence of a new wave of young Palestinian writers who began to kind of use this sort of method and find their voices and own it and begin to write, especially in the English language, at which many of them are very, very adept, especially in Gaza, to be able to write about their experiences, right? And so this is new, I think I would say, in the past 10 years you began to see this develop, which is fantastic, and being able to, again, negotiate sort of both multiple spaces and address both worlds, right? Be it sort of the Western world or the Arab world.
Yeah. And it's also, I mean, you write, there's a blog post as well in there, and you write about also hip-hop and the growth of, I guess, those kinds of music. And so there is this kind of resurgence, I guess, with this younger generation.
There is. I mean, that's sort of been around for a while. You find this really incredibly creative spirit in Gaza. You know, I think it's, you know, dire circumstances force people, right, into other, whatever means possible, right, to be able to express themselves and also to survive and to find comfort and dignity in all of these things in whatever spaces they can, right, be it the kitchen or music or, you know, art, but all of these kinds of disciplines you find tend to thrive in Gaza.
And do you find that are there connections kind of between Palestinians living in different places? Because I guess as well as Gaza and the West Bank and within Israel, there's Palestinians all around the world.
Right. And I mean, this is something I always mention is that, there's actually more Palestinians living outside of the context of the land, right, than there is inside. And I think it's very easy to forget that. And, especially being a Palestinian who sort of grew up in various places in diaspora, so I'm very cognizant of that. But I think what the Oslo Accords did is that they tried to kind of manipulate that reality and make it seem like the only sort of legitimate Palestinians or the ones that they would recognize would be the ones that were granted, you know, Israeli-issued ID cards that were either in Gaza or the West Bank, and then sort of in one fell swoop disappear or invisibilize entire, you know, millions of Palestinians who were either, you know, in Lebanon or Syria or various other camps or outside of those areas, you know, abroad, which is very dangerous. So, it's always sort of, I'm very conscious about that fact. And when I'm constantly mentioning Gaza, it's obviously because that's my context, absolutely. But it's not because I always say Gaza also is very emblematic, right, and sort of is a pilot for so many and a key to understanding so much of what else happens in Palestine. But it's not as though there's any more of a focus on it, you know, than anywhere else.
So you mentioned Oslo Accords, and I guess often the Oslo Accords are thought of in the general world as this kind of good moment.
Right, but from
Palestinian perspective, it's not seen that, and that had an effect on how you could live and where you could live and your family.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, initially, even for Palestinians, you know, it was heralded as very fleetingly as this kind of, you know, well, maybe this is something good. It's heralding this new era, you know. Mm-hmm. And then it sort of gradually, and only to sort of a select few critics who from very early on recognized it for what it was, and it was just sort of a smokescreen, and including Edward Said. But many others, it only gradually, it took time to understand sort of what it really was, and that it was just institutionalizing a lot of these realities and sort of subcontracting the occupation to, you know, an authority, a Palestinian authority, and then acting as a smokescreen for continued settlement expansion while never, you know, mentioning sort of any statehood of any kind. So it took a while for people to recognize that, and then obviously 20 years later, it's become clear that it's just kind of, you know, a completely, you know, useless bunch of ink on paper, or actually very dangerous, I should say, you know, ink on paper, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, yeah, as you said, you came back to Gaza at a certain point, so you were born outside. And So what brought you back to Gaza?
Yeah, so you know, like many Palestinians at the time, my parents were working in the Gulf. So I was born in Kuwait. Both of my parents were from Gaza. And then we would sort of constantly go back and forth, you know, principally to retain our residency status, because as I talk about frequently in the book, if one did not, as a Palestinian, retain this residency status, and your ID card, known as the Hawiya, literally identity card, about which there is, you know, a famous poem that the Palestinian poet Mahmoud Darwish wrote called, you know, Identity Card, that sort of, I've been reduced to this number on a card, right, mm-hmm. as a Palestinian. Then if you didn't go renew it, it would be, your residency rights would be revoked by Israel, and your ability to travel to your own homeland would be denied, sort of just like that. So anyway, but we felt it was like this, almost this onus as children, like, of course we didn't totally get it, but it was like this thing my mom insisted that we had to do, and, you know, it was this really arduous, like, 3-day journey that included, like, strip searches and waits on the borders, and it was, I mean, it was a horrible experience, right? Mm-hmm. But then as you get older, you, like, realize that it was just, you know, it was very grueling, but it was kind of her own sort of individual resistance against sort of the status quo mm-hmm. that intended to, you know, again, deny her rights and transfer her from her land and so on. And so it was in an effort to be able to, again, reconnect with, you know, that land and to understand more about my history and so on that, you know, I always wanted it. I thought, okay, well, I never got the chance to actually live there continuously. So when one presented itself, I thought, you know, let me take mm-hmm. it and see, you know. And then in so doing, you know, again, unbeknownst to me, it allowed me to be able to, you know, have that perspective, having lived on the outside and then having lived on the inside. So,
yep.
Yeah.
So did your parents pass on particular sort of histories and memories of their prior life in Gaza to you? What were they sort of like there?
Yeah, well, so they eventually moved back, right? Mm-hmm. So they retired and mm-hmm. you know, my mother was always very insistent that this is like, this is the place of ultimate return, right? So and they had the ability to do that because they had the ID card, and many other Palestinians didn't, right? Including my own husband, whom I met in the U.S., but who's a Palestinian with refugee status, right? So from a village near Haifa, where his parents were from, and he grew up in a refugee camp in Lebanon. So he, for example, does not have that ID card, so he would not be able to go back. So my mother was very conscious about the fact that we have mm-hmm. this right and we should, or this responsibility, as she saw it, that we mm-hmm. need to fulfill, and so therefore it's sort of our obligation to go back. So she did move back, and you know, even though technically I should be able to give my residency status to my husband, the way that the laws work is that the Israelis have frozen the process of what's known as family unification. So a Palestinian can't give her Palestinian spouse residency status. So this affects like tens of thousands of families, including some that are Palestinians who are residents of Israel and others who are residents mm-hmm. of the West Bank and others who are residents of Gaza. And you have families torn apart or living sort of illegally in their own land, right? At risk of being caught at any moment at a checkpoint or whatever. So, yeah.
And that's a really throughout the book and throughout your blog post, it's a thing that you keep coming back to.
Yeah, yeah.
There's, if I can
and read, I think primarily yeah. because it's like, it seems like it's a lot of bureaucracy, but it really gets at the crux of like understanding the way that these really these seemingly arcane laws work, yeah. you know, is sort of at the heart of, you know, how the occupation sort of controls Palestinian everyday life and really sort of severs the social ties and the fabric of society and so on.
Yeah. There's so many, and I'm sure you know some people here have read it as well. But there's you know so many incredibly poignant examples, I guess, of you trying to get through Rafah,
right.
of the book Etz that come towards the end where you're trying to come back, and Egypt won't let you in through. And I wonder, you know, that's an incredibly poignant story.
Yeah, and then you have this sort of other angle where you know people sometimes mistakenly assume that. You know, like, you know, Egypt, which, you know, neighbors Gaza's southern border, is sort of naturally an ally or something, or they have, their interests are aligned is the best way to put it. And I keep reminding people that, like, that's not the case, or it's never really been the case, right? They're, especially because they're run by the, the military. And the Egyptian military has very different interests, right, than the people. And so that's never been in their interest, and there's always been a sort of a collection of different excuses that they've used. But when the border did come ultimately under their control, they adopted and used the same sort of Israeli governing mechanisms that was part of the arrangement, right? Because they still don't have total control over that military corridor, according to the Camp David Accords, but they use the same Israeli governing principles, which is that not any Palestinian can cross that border. It has to be someone with an Israeli-issued Gaza ID card. So a West Banker can't cross into Gaza through there. Any other Palestinian can't. And that's just assuming the border is open, because the majority of the time they choose to keep it closed. So this is another element, right? You have the Israelis controlling the northern border, the Egyptians controlling the southern border, a complete naval blockade. So it really is sort of the most surveilled, closed off, you know, place on earth in that regard.
Yeah.
Even for its own residents, you know, have incredible difficulty getting in or out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry.
It's fine.
And I get, you know, how have you sort of, the book covers quite a long period of time, but also ends, I guess, a while ago. But how have things changed over the years? What differences did you see, I guess, in the...
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing because sometimes I go back and it seems like it's ancient history, but then every time I go back and like read it, I'm constantly amazed at how, not necessarily how little has changed, but how relevant so much of it still is, right? Like you could be reading it in the present time and so much of it would still apply. Mm-hmm. And that's just a very sad reminder that the overarching, you know, situation and occupation and so forth has not changed. And it's, I think I constantly talk about in the book, this desire by sort of the powers that be to maintain a status quo. And as long as that status quo, there's no aberration, then, you know, it'll just, you know, it can be stagnant, but then, okay, don't make a fuss or don't, you know, and then things will be fine. You can live in this sort of, semi normalcy, right? And I think I also quote Mahmoud Darwish again, because I find it, again, very poignant about choosing a harmless slavery but in total freedom. And that's like a very good example of what, you know, it's like, you know, you can, you know, it'll appear to you, you know, as though you have freedom and things are calm and normal and there isn't sort of an active attack or assault. But in reality, the borders are still there, the restrictions are still there, and so on. And I talk about that in the context of the disengagement as well in 2005, where, you know, people were really excited because suddenly the internal checkpoints that, you know, really crippled daily movement were no longer there. The settlements were dismantled. But again, the exterior, nothing had really changed except sort of it was just reformatted or restructured in a way, right? So you didn't have the settlements inside Gaza. They were located to the West Bank. You didn't have soldiers in your face, but they're sort of surrounding you from the perimeter, you know, and on and on. So that's kind of the way I would say it's changed, just been reformatted in a way that, you know, seems less, you know, offensive, but is you know, is probably arguably far more, I think, dangerous in the sense that I feel like the Israeli military is more willing and able now to, you know, in moments where there are so-called aberrations, to use a different kind of force than they would have before. You know, they yeah. feel like I feel like they have the leisure to do that now because there aren't any of their citizens inside that they yeah. would have put at risk. And so that's the real fear is yeah. It's almost like a laboratory now where they can kind of do whatever. What they want and try what they want. And you're kind of all these little guinea pigs living inside. Yeah. So.
Yeah. And you talk about how there's kind of a control on food. And it's not yeah. the point isn't to kill people, but it's to keep them kind of just...
Yeah, and it's really, I mean, and I talk a little bit about this in the Gaza kitchen, I mean, in just one mm-hmm. segment, not the whole thing, about how Gaza is almost a sort of really sort of twisted experiment in post-colonial, de-development theory and so forth, in the sense of like, okay, you have this kind of captive population, and this, you know, territory that's mm-hmm. like, you know, neither sovereign nor, it's effectively occupied, but not fully militarily occupied, but it's fully controlled. And so, you know, how can we utilize this sort of economically and otherwise, while at the same time keeping a full out humanitarian crisis at bay? And these are all sort of documented facts. It's not kind of like a conspiracy. Yeah. There's things that have actually officially been stated, right?
Yep.
Is like I think the advisor to Ariel Sharon at the time said something like, the idea is to put Palestinians on a diet but not starve them to death. Or, you know, using these kinds of caloric formulas to ensure that, you know, in case anybody cries foul, that, well, look, everyone is getting exactly whatever it is, 2,000 calories, so you can't complain, right? Yeah. Where it's been sort of systematic and deliberate impoverishment and de-development and people's, you know, access to goods and ingredients has diminished remarkably. Even though things might be available, people just can't, you know, afford to buy them. And beyond that, it's just completely crippled any ability to, you know, develop or prosper. And, you know, people are not sort of, they're just barely surviving, right?
Yeah.
I quote, the director of the UN field office there said something like nobody's starving, but everybody is hungry, right? So it's kind of you're constantly, I think he described it as an intravenous drip of relief. So there's constantly sort of this stream, this IV line of things coming in, but it's never enough to kind of, you know, fully like sustain people.
I was always so struck, I guess, reading your book and reading, whenever I read things written by Palestinians in Gaza or, you know, from any of these kinds of situations where it is kind of hard in the general sense to get information. And one of those moments, I guess, is also when you talk about the bees and that the honey that's closer to the border
right.
is better honey because the bees can go and eat the Israeli flowers.
Right.
Because there aren't flowers in Gaza.
Yeah,
and
there's constant reminders that, you know, obviously, borders are man-made and manufactured, and they were not there. I mean, people think of the Gaza Strip as an entity that's always existed, right?
Yeah.
But it actually didn't, like, prior to 1948 and the Egyptian-Israeli armistice agreement. It was just the Gaza region, right? And it was divided into districts that initially were administered by the British and so on. And it was regions and people would flow in and out, and it was Gaza City was the closest city to which many refugees sought shelter, right, when they were evicted from their homes and so on. But then you had these borders placed conveniently sort of around where most of those refugees had fled, and then they were obviously prevented from returning home. But yeah, I talk about how, and the reason that the bees know no boundaries, right, so they can travel across the borders, and the reason they do that, not that they, you know, purposefully want to travel across the border, is because so many of the eucalyptus and other trees that house, you know, beneficial insects like bees and others have been cut down or uprooted by Israeli bulldozers and so forth because they're along the border, and like more than half of that farmland has been completely cleared. And so obviously they need to look for other areas to pollinate, and that's what happens is that they cross the border and people see the irony in this because farmers will say to you this is from near the border or whatever, so
I guess another thing you talk about, which is is the planes that the Israeli jets that come over, and you talk particularly I guess during the different operations that happen around mid-2000s of the effects, I guess, of the incredible effects of these Israeli jets that deliberately break the sound barrier.
Right. Yeah.
And of how that's in a way as a, I guess, a different kind of violence to the dropping of bombs, but...
Yeah, for a while they were... I mean, this is before sort of the full-blown assaults that succeeded this particular tactic, which now is considered sort of soft tactic compared to what came after it. But yeah, you would have, again, jets that wouldn't do this before because there would have been Israelis living in Gaza before 2005. After that point, they began sort of in retaliation for, you know, again, any aberrations or whatever. They would deliberately break the sound barrier over the civilian populations, creating incredible, like, shockwaves across the city. And it was severely criticized at that point. And, you know, I think it lasted for about, you know, 6 to 9 months, and then that stopped. But then again, far worse things came afterwards. So, yeah.
So I guess there's also, I mean, your cooking is obviously a big part of what you do. And I guess, you know, this... I wonder if you see it as part of a kind of a form of resistance to what's going on, or how do you kind of think about your
cooking absolutely. Work? I mean, in fact, you know, part of what I try to do, or part of what I have constantly thought about ever since my time in Gaza, was, you know, again, different ways in which one can convey the Palestinian experience, right? Mm-hmm. And one of those ways, beyond writing about sort of, you know, like the diary entries of my own personal experience, was to use the lens of food, because as with many other things, Palestinians in Gaza are very passionate about their food, and they're sort of well known for their food across Palestine as well. And that in and of itself, I think, was interesting enough to me, right, to document this sort of very interesting and unique cuisine with a you know, history that dates back to the Abbasid Caliphate and so on, and Gaza being sort of at the nexus of various trade and spice routes and crossroads between continents and along the Mediterranean, absorbed all these different flavors and influences in a sort of very sort of geographically isolated area. But beyond that, what was really interesting is that because so many Palestinians sought refuge in Gaza in the 1948 exodus, and then were denied from going back, and they continued to cook the same sorts of dishes that their parents and their grandparents cooked in a very sort of regionally specific way, it makes Gaza an incredible place to encounter a wide array of culinary flavors across Palestine in this tiny little pocket. But also, I mean, what we found is that, you know, the kitchen is an incredible place, you know, where, like, histories gets perpetuated and stories get told and dignities crafted, you know, all with the, again, the backdrop of the bigger geopolitical issues that exist that you can get to, but by focusing in, zooming in on the kind of very personal, private, intimate spaces where we found there's incredible joy and there's, and it's incredible, if you just stick a microphone in someone's face and say, what's your opinion on Hamas? Or you kind of go to the kitchen and you cook with them and you see what they're doing and what, and you hear their stories, you're going to get much more out of it that way, right? And so we really wanted to document that and those ordinary moments and the beauty and all of that and the celebration of the life while not ignoring how all of that is affected by the bigger geopolitical issues. So it's kind of at the intersection of both of those topics.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I guess, you know, at that intersection is, of course, the blockade, which restricts what foods can be brought in. Is that right?
Exactly.
So
has
the blockade changed?
Yeah, it definitely, I mean, we noticed that a lot of the major sort of traditional ingredients that would have been used as staples, like, you know, olive oil, for example, is the major one, because of the sort of mass dependence on food aid handouts, which are supposed to be a temporary measure, right, but have become a long-term sort of reality for about 75% of the population, you find that most people can no longer afford to use, like, olive oil in the way it was once traditionally used because it's so prohibitively expensive, and what little they do use or is gifted to them or they buy would be used sparingly, right? Mm-hmm. So instead, the rationed items like soy oil, or, you know, white sugar, white flour, all these kinds of things are the ones that have kind of made their way into the diet as substitutes for the traditional grains and things like this. So the same dishes are made but with a lot of sort of substitutions. And so we really wanted to be able to document sort of the and codify the traditional knowledge before it was lost.
Yeah. And you were saying before, we were talking before, that it's quite unusual, I guess, to do the kind of book that this kind of blending of politics and cooking in a book. And so what has been the response from within Gaza?
Yeah, well, you know, So you had the response in Gaza and the response on the outside. So when we were initially trying to find publishers, it really produced a lot of, like, you know, head scratching, because the mainstream sort of cookbook publishing world just wanted the cooking, right? They didn't want sort of this controversial political stuff. And the sort of more left-leaning progressive publishers, like, just wanted the politics. And the idea of somehow writing about both, or writing about Gaza in the context of food, given, you know, all of what was going on, seemed like ridiculously frivolous to the, to the publishers. So while a lot of the Western publishing world didn't quite understand, and even a lot of initially audiences were like, you know, Gaza, food, like what, politics, you know, what is this? Everyone in Gaza immediately understood that it was about so much more than just food, and were, you know, extremely delighted to be able to see images of themselves that they recognized that weren't completely caricatured, anonymous portrayals, to see the food documented, of which were they're very passionate, to see their stories. So our initial intuition was sort of validated again and again. And they're constantly thrilled, and, you know, we see it all over the place whenever we do have a chance to go. So that was really rewarding, even though I'm sometimes still produces head scratching, like in other areas of the Middle East, where they just, the idea of writing about both food and politics still doesn't totally make sense. Everyone there gets it.
And so what's your favorite Gazan dish to cook?
Oh gosh, that's hard to say, but I'm awfully partial to any of the seafood dishes, because they're really incredible. And Gaza is the last part of the sort of Palestinian territories that has access to the sea, although other cities do. So in the West Bank, they wouldn't have access. So and that comes from a long tradition of seafood, not just from Gaza, but also from Yaffa and elsewhere. But then a lot of the traditional sort of rural dishes are just so comforting and fantastic. And one of my favorites that would be in season right now in the beginning of autumn is Rumania, which is a vegetarian lentil and pomegranate and eggplant. I call it a stew, but it's really, there's a lot of these one bowl, like one pot meals that are cooked and then served in bowls, and then you just kind of, you know, sit around and eat them with bread. So that's a fantastic one, because it has a lot of really, you know, unique culinary elements to Gaza, and you know, an unusual combination of flavors of, like, the sweet and the sour. And again, a lot of it dates back to kind of medieval times, the combination of the souring agents. And it uses sour pomegranate juice, which is a completely different variety than I think most people know. It's a pomegranate with a green exterior that's, you know, used exclusively for its, like, sour juice, you know. So, yeah, but a lot of these really very traditional dishes I absolutely love, and you wouldn't really see them in any restaurants or anything like that.
And were there particular moments when you were putting together the book and you're traveling, were there new recipes that you learned or particular techniques that
Absolutely. And, you know, we were constantly, you know, I had to constantly remind people, like, I apologize if there's things that I missed or if things that seem wrong to you, just come and tell me. Especially, that's why we felt this urgency for the second edition, because we had a lot of people saying, yes, but don't forget this, or, but this is, we make it in a different way, or depending on if you went sort of 1 kilometer this way, 1 kilometer that way, we know this should be done with onions, not garlic, or we don't add cumin to it, or, you know, people were very passionate about these little tiny differences, and there were some corrections and some additions, and I definitely learned a lot, because, you know, it's, my parents are both from sort of urban centers, so they wouldn't have known a lot of the sort of dishes that would have been made in the farming areas, and, you know, so I picked up a lot of information for sure.
Excellent. And so your parents are still in Gaza?
Yeah.
And so you've been back more recently, or?
So it's been really difficult ever since the Sisi regime took over in Cairo to get in. So the last time I was actually able to go was in 2013, when I filmed the episode with Anthony Bourdain. And after that, it was just a week after that the coup happened. And so it's been really hard. I mean, it doesn't always make the headlines, but there's, you know, hundreds of cases of Palestinians, especially young people who try to go or are, you know, detained in the airport or spend months waiting to get in. And if they do get in, you know, which is more likely, then it takes on average 9 months for anyone to get out again. So that's the real problem. Unless you have a lot of time to spare, it's you know, it's really risky, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. And what was it like, I guess, taking Anthony Bourdain there and, I guess, seeing Gaza through his eyes in a way?
I mean, it was absolutely incredible and, you know, very sort of, the whole thing was very serendipitous and the timing was very fortuitous. It was great. I mean, it was like a real dream to be able to take him, you know, into the private homes of people who were so welcoming and just, you know, of course, the sense of time that he had and what people had were, you know, the last scene was just, it took like more than half the day and mm-hmm. and people were just chilling and he was like, we're on the clock here, you know, so, but it was great. I mean, it was a bit stressful because my daughter at the time was like 4 months old and she wouldn't stop crying and I was like panicking and she wanted to breastfeed yeah. and the producers were like, you know, shut her up and, you know, and then he was like, here, let me take her, you know, he was like the baby whisperer. He just took her and like, you know, and put her right to sleep. So, but it was really rewarding and I got so much positive feedback from people who said to me it was the first mm-hmm. time they had seen like human portrayals of Palestinians on mainstream mm-hmm. American television. So even that was enough for me, you know, to have heard that, and I feel like I made some small dent or contribution in sort of changing the dominant discourse out there.
And I guess, I mean, something we haven't really talked about yet is your mothering and the way that mothering plays and parenting plays such a big role in what you're...
I know. Somebody was mentioning how everybody made such a big fuss about the guy who was doing an interview on the BBC and... He couldn't shut his daughter, or his daughter came, and everybody was like, well, any mother knows this is, you would complete normal. You could just,
But yeah, so your kids have all been to Gaza?
I always make a point to, you know, again, it's been much more difficult for the past 2 years, but they've all been. I mean, probably my youngest doesn't have a recollection because she was quite young, but I make sure to be able to go as often as I can, and we don't go there, we go visit my husband's family, of mm-hmm. course, they're in a refugee camp in Lebanon, and so that in and of itself is sort of another sort of very bizarre experience, because they're also very sort of segregated from mainstream Lebanese society, and none of them have ever been, or very few have been to Palestine, but they sort of live and breathe Palestine and know nothing else except being Palestinian. So they, again, navigate both and negotiate both of those worlds.
So I guess we might, it's probably time now to open it up for audience questions, which I'm sure there are many in the audience. And there's people with microphones who will, there's someone down the
front. Yeah, and I hope they can hear us back there.
Yeah.
It seems so far away.
I want to thank the Wheeler Centre and you guys for a very illuminating discussion tonight. Thank you very much indeed.
It was our pleasure. Thank you.
I've been an observer from a distance of the Middle East situation for over 50 years now, and I don't think I've ever seen it as disrupted as it is now. Mm. Can I ask you to reflect on the fact that there are 1.6 million Palestinians living in Israel, mm-hmm. relatively peacefully, and I appreciate everything isn't hunky-dory, but across the Middle East, it appears that Muslims can't live with each other in many respects, if you could address that. You mentioned strip searches. I took my 89-year-old mother to the airport for an overseas flight a couple of years ago, and because she had twin hip replacements, she got a strip search as well. So I apologise for the situation where Palestinians get it every day, but security causes all kinds of disruptions.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for coming. I appreciate it, and I appreciate your honesty. I mean, I'll just start by saying the first two comments, I think they're more sort of like tropes or myths that are kind of out there, because there's actually more Muslims living outside of the Middle East than inside. So I think we have this tendency to conflate, like, Arab, Muslim, or we think it's very easy and convenient to be able to say Muslims just can't get along, right? But what does that actually mean, and, you know, who are we actually talking about? So it's really important to make those distinctions. And in terms of the comment about Palestinians, you know, the borders changed on them, obviously, and there's dozens of laws that specifically apply to them that discriminate against them. disallow them from, you know, doing certain things, living in certain places. Like I mentioned earlier, the family unification law. I don't know if you know, but that's an Israeli law that's been passed that specifically only applies to the Palestinian citizens of Israel. That says they are not allowed to legally marry other Palestinians from the West Bank or Gaza, legally. And so you, again, you have dozens of cases. There's a great website called loveunderapartheid.com that I urge you to look at, and it talks of testimonies of Palestinians who live these very, you know, ruptured lives, because, you know, and again, it's their indigenous homeland. There's a law that says the number of Jews has to outweigh the number of non-Jews in the city of Jerusalem to a ratio of 75% to 25%, for example. And in line with that, there is policies that have been set out to ensure that remains the case, to transfer Palestinians out of their homes there. That only applies to them. If Palestinian Jerusalemites are not there for a certain number of years, their residency rights of Jerusalem are revoked, and that doesn't apply to non-Palestinians of the city. So, you know, we shouldn't be deceived in any way. We shouldn't confuse, you know, submission, for example, or pacification for peace in any way. And the same applies for Gaza. I was mentioning earlier, just because things appear quiet, you know, it doesn't mean that people necessarily have their freedoms or that that is a positive situation. So it's important to keep those things in mind. Palestinian lives have been ruptured, you know, rights have been denied, freedoms continually get trampled on, be they Palestinians, you know, on the inside, or Palestinians in the territories, or Palestinians on the outside, who are just all, you know, denied their rights to return to their own indigenous homeland, and with which they know nothing else. And this really doesn't apply like anywhere else on earth, where you would just deny a population their right to return to their own homes. I mean, I guess that's in summary, but it is, I can't remember, the strip searching. So, and again, you know, I was just having a conversation earlier about the visa process to come here and how seamless and easy it was, and how it was like, you know, I applied online and it was like the easiest process ever, and they did whatever checks they needed, and it wasn't even a stamp, it was electronic, and I came in and like all was well. So again, and I was having this conversation with my husband about how now with Donald Trump, they're trying to adopt a lot of the sort of very in-your-face kind of like Israeli security policies that don't make people safer per se, just because you're strip-searching people or subjecting them to hours-long wait every time they need to go to work or university. That doesn't make people safer. Like, walls don't make people safer. Strip searches don't make people safer. I mean, there's, you know, x-ray machines, and there's all kinds of really advanced security systems that are in place to avoid all that. So again, we shouldn't confuse those two things. And it is and it's not just an inconvenience for Palestinians, it's a daily part of their lives that makes a simple 10-minute commute a 4-hour, you know, uncertain journey every time you need to go, you know, to work or to school or whatever.
And sorry, just I mean, that's something you sort of touch on in the book, is that it is this kind of enforced waiting and this temporariness and always not knowing if you're going to be let through, which I guess marks, you say, Palestinianness in a way.
Yeah, absolutely. And Rashid Al-Khalidi, again, a Palestinian scholar, has written a lot about this uncertainty and defining the Palestinian experience, just sort of the quintessential Palestinian experience being found at borders, you know, is that every time you're at a border and there's sort of this element of uncertainty associated with whether you'll get in or not, how long you'll have to wait, especially, you know, those who are living on the inside. Like, for example, within the West Bank, there's 415 different, military checkpoints, barriers, trenches, obstructions, whatever, scattered throughout that very small area. And not to mention the complete, you know, separation of the West Bank from Gaza, which I think a lot of people forget. There's absolutely no connection between those two areas. But I just wanted to say one other thing. Again, I talked about the conflation. I don't want to get too off track. You know, and being very careful to kind of, you know, generalize or make the generalizations about sort of Muslim violence. But my husband, if he was here, he gets really up in arms about this, frequently points out to the most sort of violent periods in history. And, you know, basically I'm saying it doesn't mean anything, right? But if you were to really look at the bloodiest times in history or the most violent times in history, it wouldn't actually have been now, right? Or it wouldn't even have been between, like, you know, whatever that means, like Muslim peoples, right? It would have been probably during the Second World War or during Brother Khmer Rouge or whatever, on and on and on. But that doesn't really tell us anything, is what I'm trying to say. So we should be very careful about saying these people can't get along. Who is these people, right? And what is it that they're getting along or not getting along about, I guess. So,
Thank you very much for your talk. Looking at what's been happening, it feels like that Gaza and Israel have been in a state of war of one level or another for decades. The government of Gaza is looking at has an objective of destroying Israel's existence, and Israel, it doesn't look like it's going to cease to exist, and the Palestinians don't look like they're going to cease to exist. The question is really, what's the solution? I mean, there are clearly many, many problems, and I understand the difficulties of living there, but it feels like it is a state of war at one level or another, and the question is, what's the solution? You know, I can see the problems.
Sure. Well, sorry, where am I looking? I feel like I'm looking at the wrong place. Yeah. Was I looking? Oh, I was looking at the right place. Okay. It can be very easy. I'll be the first to admit to kind of become really fatalistic or cynical, which is maybe why I often choose to kind of look at it from a different angle that constantly gives me hope. And you know, every time I go back or I like speak, I mean, I think I talk about this in the book, with, for example, farmers who are sort of, you know, without even a fuss or a ruckus or a, like, look at me, are replanting their olive groves for, like, the third time. And anybody who has farmed knows that it takes about 7 or 8 years for a tree to become fruitful again because his farm has been uprooted. And saying that this is, I mean, I have no option but to be optimistic and hopeful. I take my cue from them, right? And their celebration of life and optimism and hope and just sort of pressing forward because they have no choice. But if you wanted sort of more practical advice or a more practical vision, again, I don't dwell so much on the sort of the geopolitical reality, just meaning like the parties and what they say, because I always say people, you know, besides being creatures of habit, are voting depending on their circumstance, be it in the United States, right? Like, why on earth would they vote for Donald Trump? Be it, like, in Gaza, just because, you know, they voted for Hamas at that point, it doesn't necessarily mean anything. It meant that they were thinking about their domestic circumstances, and at that point in time, it was a complete local security lapse. And so they were thinking not in terms of the grander political picture, but in terms of the local political lapse in security and sort of how that could be enforced, right? And so that's how people vote, with their sort of very specific personal interests in mind. If we were getting into details about, you know, who thinks what and who does what, I always remind people of that's what we're going to be nitpicking about. The Likud charter flatly rejects the establishment of a Palestinian state and rejects the existence of Palestinians. So what does that mean in the end, you know? If we're actually thinking of practical solutions, I'm personally like a believer in that the only sustainable solution is sort of a one-state democratic solution in whatever form that takes, right? Like in confederation or whatever. But I feel like it's really the only realistic, practical, sustainable, and just solution for both peoples in the sense that it would sort of resolve all the various issues, because I don't feel like Israel can maintain or sustain itself as a so-called democracy while maintaining a sort of ethnic religious majority. Sort of something has to give, right? You can't do that and also be try to maintain the democracy without resorting to measures which they already have, like transfer or population control or whatever, things like this, to try to maintain this demographic balance. So that's kind of where I see, and people may say it's not realistic, it's whatever. It's not, well, neither is a two-state solution. I mean, that's just sort of the conventional wisdom that we've been taught that is the only path forward, which is not, as anyone will tell you who has studied a map or been there, is just a completely bankrupt idea at this point.
Hello, thank you very much for your talk. I lived in Nablus for a year in 2011, and I taught in refugee camps in and around Nablus. And I was struck by the vast majority of my students and people that I spoke to in 2011 who said that no matter what, they would never leave Palestine. There was that really strong connection to the Palestinian cause and to their land. Last year, I went back for 3 months and was struck by how that had changed and how so many young people were talking about wanting to leave and wanting to make something of their lives because employment is so difficult. And connected to that, there were a lot of Palestinians that were very judgmental of those Palestinians who wanted to leave, as if they'd given up. I was wondering if you could share your opinion on those Palestinians who are wanting to make something of their lives, and obviously...
Yeah. I mean, my opinion has always been I can't blame anybody for, you know, wanting to do what they feel is best in their individual circumstances, because life can be intolerable, and especially if you're a young person. I think it's different if you're kind of maybe established to older, or you have a career or something. And there are people, you know, I always remind people that there is a segment of the population that either are sort of urban elite or whatever, or they have certain jobs that are sustainable for them. But others, especially for the younger populations, that there is no sort of horizon, right? For some, it's incredibly difficult to access universities because of the travel restrictions. If you're in Gaza, you can't access Bir Zeit in the West Bank. And it's very difficult to, if you have a scholarship, to travel out to pursue that. And so I can't blame especially a young person who wants to be able to go out and, you know, even if it's just to see the world or interact with other, you know, people or whatever, because it does give you perspective, right? And I understand that that's becoming the case more and more. I know that especially for Jerusalemites, they have sort of a, you know, heightened sense of obligation and urgency in terms of retaining their Jerusalem ID cards and at all costs possible not losing it and trying to stay there or renew it. And it's led to all sorts of sort of absurd and tragic situations. I mean, I met a Palestinian man who was like selling ice cream in North Carolina once, who had developed this entire scheme to be able, his wife was from Jerusalem, he's from Bethlehem. They didn't want to lose the Jerusalem status, so he would like scale the separation barrier every day, and then he would get caught and kicked back to Bethlehem, and he couldn't see his family, so he went all the way to the U.S. to try to get U.S. citizenship so he could go back and live in Palestine, you know, even though he would have to go out every 3 months to renew his visa, just so he could stay. So you do have people like that who will go to extreme lengths to do what they can to stay, and others that just feel it's not tolerable and need to go. And I feel like it's not my position to judge, because I, you know, having been the child of parents who had to make that decision as well, right, who went out to further their careers and so forth and give their children a better life, and then ultimately decided to return back. You know, people are human beings, I guess, in the end of the day, and make decisions based on what they feel is in their best interest. But of course, as Palestinians, we have this added sort of burden and you know, again, urgency of, you know, like I was saying, preservation in a way, right? Identity preservation, you know, residency preservation, and so on and so forth.
I'm just wondering, how could the UN sort of take control of the situation and try and create a one state or solution?
How could they or should they, are you saying? I mean, I don't think the Israelis would allow them to, right? That's really the idea here, even if it was proposed, you know, which it has been at various times. I think the idea is that the Israelis view it as sort of their, like, sovereign terrain, and they don't want anyone interfering. I think my idea is... is that more the situation will sort of force their hand at some point. And I think the Israeli leaders recognize that because of sort of numerous allusions and statements they've made to the fact that if we don't do something quick, whatever that solution might be, then we are going to become an apartheid state, right? Like Shimon Peres has said this, Rabin has said this. Several Israeli leaders have noted, you know, that this might become the reality.
Thanks. I wanted to ask you, I was reading that a lot of Syrian refugees are actually arriving in Gaza and settling there as an attempt to restart their lives, and that raises a whole number of questions and thoughts for me. But I was wondering, just if we talk about food again, how you think, what's the future for sort of culture and particularly food culture in Gaza?
Yeah, I don't think a whole lot are arriving because it's really, really difficult to get into Gaza now. There was a time, where, like, again, that year before the coup in Egypt, the border was much easier to cross illicitly through the underground network of tunnels that have since been sort of completely shut down. And so a lot of Syrians were arriving that way. And I wouldn't even say a lot, but the fact that you would seek refuge in Gaza must mean that you're pretty desperate from of all the options. And but I think some people did because there was no, I mean, even the Syrians became sort of like the second Palestinians. Very few countries would take them. And so there were a few that, for them, that was the only option. I mean, not a whole lot, but there are certainly a few notable ones, and a couple of them became famous because they opened restaurants and there was a bunch of news articles written about them, and so on. So it's like, you know, Gaza's a tiny place, but it is kind of a food hub, and they're food lovers, and there's been several cases, not just the Syrians. There's been Palestinians from Nablus who were exiled to Gaza, who were former prisoners in Israel, and then, again, this is one of the things that Gaza has become is like a sort of a dumping ground, not just for food, but for you know, anybody that's unwanted, right? And they opened a place like a patisserie, like a Nablus is known for its kanafa, right? The cheese pastries. And there's always like long queues and it's become really famous. So same sort of thing. Gaza very easily adopts like other food cultures. And this you've noticed this throughout history. They adopt culinary influences, be it from the spice routes, be it from the Mediterranean, whatever. They're, you know, those who have lived abroad bring with them, like many were in Thailand. There's a bunch of Thai restaurants there. Whatever trend or whatever, you know, and again, it's hard because the border is not open, but those who do have a chance to go out and come back frequently will open restaurants, and that, again, doesn't change the traditional diet, but you certainly see an influence in terms of what people are cooking on a sort of a daily basis, you know, whatever's trendy kind of thing.
We are sadly out of time, but I guess I just, you know, want to end by saying that, you know, I guess really important thing to do out of this is to pay more attention to what's
for sure
coming out of Gaza and to learn how to cook some Gazan food, which you can do by buying Layla's cookbook, which is available up the back. And will you join me in thanking Layla for her time?
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing, and ideas from Melbourne, Australia, and the world.